You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. Check out our website at thetakeaway.org. You'll find other interesting stories, quizzes, and behind-the-scenes photos and videos.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And on this third Monday in December, a special conversation with a journalist who's had an amazing year. He's been partly responsible for transforming our understanding of how the United States conducts intelligence since the September 11th attacks. Glenn Greenwald received the leaked documents from former security official Edward Snowden, who used his top security clearance with a government contractor to uncover a vast set of programs where the National Security Agency was watching American citizens. The U.S. government had quietly and completely changed its way of doing things, using advanced technology and a sense of righteousness in the wake of the September 11th, 2001 attacks. Here's then Vice President Dick Cheney speaking on NBC's Meet the Press on September 16th, 2001, with late Tim Russert. America was going to change, he said then.
A lot of what needs to be done here will have to be done quietly, without any discussion, using sources and methods that are available to our intelligence agencies, if we're going to be successful.
There have been restrictions placed on the United States intelligence gathering, reluctance to use unsavory characters, those who violated human rights, to assist in intelligence gathering. Will we lift some of those restrictions?
Well, I think so. I think one of the byproducts, if you will, of this tragic set of circumstances is that we'll see a very thorough sort of reassessment of how we operate and the kinds of people we deal with. If you're going to deal only with officially approved, certified good guys, you're not going to find out what the bad guys are doing.
How much America changed became clear with the Snowden leaks this year. A vast archive of secrets we have barely begun to understand. Reporter, writer, commentator, civil libertarian Glenn Greenwald spoke with us from Brazil, where he says he fears possible prosecution by the U.S. government. Greenwald says the Snowden revelations show that in the years since 9/11, not only has the United States become more like Dick Cheney's bad guys, we're also less safe.
I absolutely think that doing nothing would have been better than what we did, because what we did ended up creating so much more problems in terms of a terrorist threat than ever existed prior to 9/11. I mean, if you go around the world and spend a decade beating your chest and declaring yourself a nation at war, dropping bombs in multiple countries on the planet, killing all sorts of innocent men, women, and children, putting people in cages without trial, creating a worldwide torture regime, popping up dictators, what you're essentially telling the world is you ought to hate us and you ought to be filled with rage and want to bring the kinds of violence to our country that we saw on 9/11. There were all sorts of things that could have been done that were reasonable security measures in terms of tightening up the borders, focusing more on the people who we had reason to believe were genuinely the kind of threat that we were worried about. We could have provided better aid to the countries that were combating extremism, helped, instead of building huge surveillance systems, alleviated a lot of the poverty and misery and primitive conditions in countries that fuel terrorism. There are all kinds of things that we could have done to reduce that threat further, but I think what we did made the threat much, much worse, and at the same time destroyed many of the freedoms that we've all been taught define what the United States is about.
All right. In terms of whether the government is permitted to carry out surveillance against American citizens, or whether there is a value to the data that a company like Google or Apple or AT&T might have about American citizens, the Constitution has a lot to say about what the government can do with that data. It has almost nothing to say about what corporations can do with that data. In the commercial world, is the era of privacy and constitutional government really over? And it's sort of immaterial whether the government is watching you or Google is watching you at this stage in 2013?
I'd say two things about that. Number one is that there's a reason why the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, restricts what states can do to you, but not corporations or private actors. And that is because the government has a whole set of very extreme powers that make it a different and more threatening kind of actor. It can put you into prison. It can actually take your life. It can take your property. It can tax you. It can monitor you for all sorts of purposes. And so I think it's always been understood that having a government do something like gather ubiquitous information about what citizens are doing poses a greater threat than corporations doing it, because even though it is a threat when corporations do it, they tend to do it for profit motive rather than to, say, weed out political dissidents or blackmail Martin Luther King, as J. Edgar Hoover did, and the like. So I think there is a significant difference. But even on the corporate level, I think one of the things that you're seeing in terms of the last 6 months of the reporting we've done is a lot of different kinds of pressure being put on private corporations like Google and Facebook to start taking the privacy of their customers a lot more seriously.
Is there a difference, though, between a sense of, you know, reverence for the Constitution and, you know, the government staying out of your business, and maybe being more concerned about your brand? I'm wondering if Facebook really cares about the Constitution, or just cares about not having Eric Holder being on its front page.
Right. I think the thing that Facebook cares about most is the recognition that in order to continue to grow as a company, it needs to have the trust of hundreds of millions of people around the world who they want to use their service. And if the message continues to be communicated to the rest of the world by the U.S. government, which is, we do protect the privacy of Americans, but we don't actually protect the privacy of non-Americans. All these programs that are being revealed, these are only aimed at foreign nationals, which isn't really true, but it's what the government's saying. I think that's the kind of thing that really is jeopardizing the ability of U.S. tech firms to compete. And ultimately, corporations are going to be guided by their own self-interest. You can't expect them to act morally. And so if you're somebody who wants to defend privacy and to re-institutionalize the idea that you can do things on the internet without people being monitored, I think the important thing is to raise the cost to companies like Facebook and Google from participating in this kind of privacy assault. And I do think that's what's happening.
Over the last year, have you noticed that there's kind of this subgenre of media, of journalism, of broadcast journalism, you know, kind of like, you know, match wits with Glenn Greenwald, debates of you going viral all over the place, you versus Andrew Sullivan, you versus Dina Temple Raston. I mean, I can find all kinds of little boxing matches with you and either other journalists or pundits. What do you think of all that?
I mean, in general, I think that adversarial journalism and a clash of ideas can be a really constructive way to test people's views and to find truth. I think the problem comes when that kind of aggression and that kind of adversarial posture is directed at people who don't wield a lot of power in official Washington, who tend to be outsiders. And then suddenly when those very same people who get very aggressive when dealing with people like that are before generals with lots of medals on their chest or big established journalists who are revered in Washington, the tone changes completely and it becomes one of great deference and an aversion to confrontation. And I think that's when things get quite telling. But in general, you know, I think if you're out there and you're having an impact on the public discourse and you're making claims that people ought to listen to what you have to say, as I do, then you're absolutely fair game to have your viewpoints challenged aggressively. You just need to be prepared to have your own views challenged aggressively back.
Getting back to the Snowden leaks, and it's really a story of technology and journalism and the Constitution. And this is really an old story. Let's take the nuclear example. Some scientists go to the government and say, hey, you know, we can do this with these atoms and we should develop this to stop Hitler. And the government says, great, let's get started on that. We'll definitely do that. Oh, you know what? We're not going to bother with Hitler, but we are going to kill 100,000 civilians in Japan. It's an old story. Technology becomes available. Government uses it for what it wants. And people who stand around going, oh, gosh, they lied to us. It's kind of an old story. It's kind of naive. What would you expect they would do with this technology?
Yeah, I don't disagree with what you say, you know, except that I would say the following. You know, I've been doing a lot of reporting on from NSA documents in lots of different countries. And so we'll report on mass NSA spying in Norway or in Brazil. And I always get asked by the journalists in those countries, well, we're just Norway. Why is the NSA spying on us? Why are they interested in us? Or same question in Brazil. And the answer is that the United States doesn't actually need, or the NSA doesn't need a specific reason in order to spy on people and collect their communications. They do it because they've developed this technology that lets them do it. And their institutional mandate is just to constantly seek out more and more. They don't need a reason. Their only reason for existing is, we've developed this technology originally to target people in Iraq in a war zone, but now that we have it, we're going to use it across the board. And you're right, that is a common dynamic, that technology gets out of control. But that's the reason why there needs to be transparency, so people know what's being done, why there needs to be accountability, so there are limits on it.
But you can't develop, you know, a nuclear bomb with transparency and telling everybody what you're doing. I mean, there are technological developments that happen in secret, and that's the way things are done. And when the Constitution gets involved later on, that's something else. But I guess I don't quite see how we're going to avoid this kind of thing by simply arguing that people be constrained. They're definitely not. They don't do it this way.
Well, take your nuclear example, which is a really good one. Countries began developing nuclear weapons in total secrecy. There was no framework for them. There were no limitations on any kind about how they could be used or stored. And the world realized that that was a really bad and dangerous thing to do, to let nuclear development take place outside of a framework of international accountability. And so countries got together and they created treaties and conventions and a nuclear regulatory framework to ensure that there are inspections and that there are rules that countries agree to and abide by for how to safely manage this technology that could have spun out of control if it didn't have that kind of framework. And that's how I see surveillance technology. You're right. Human beings are always going to try and develop more technologies to give themselves greater power. And the challenge is for them is for other human beings to organize on their own to come up with ways to control and limit that technology so it doesn't do massive amounts of harm. And this kind of tension is critical.
All right. So have you thought about what the equivalent of the International Atomic Energy Agency is in terms of surveillance using technological tools?
Yeah, I think it's twofold. Number one is I think you are now seeing countries around the world banding together to start to figure out ways to reconstruct the internet so that it doesn't all go through essentially one country, the United States, and subject the physical infrastructure of the internet to international oversight instead of just control by the U.S. government so that one government can't invade the communications of everybody else. And then I also think that there are individual solutions being developed, such as technological innovations in cryptography and encryption, in creation of all kinds of independent networks that'll make it very difficult, if not impossible, for the U.S. government and other governments around the world to invade those networks. So I think technology will provide an answer as well, as it so often does, to the problems that it's created.
Glenn Greenwald is the journalist who worked with the former NSA contractor Edward Snowden to publish and report on classified NSA programs. You can find a full transcript of our interview with Greenwald by visiting our website, thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
One way in which America changed immediately after the September 11th attacks was the enlargement of the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center, a legal netherworld with detainees variously held without being charged or on trial for crimes the details of which cannot even be told in open court because they involve CIA methods that remain secret. A second set of pretrial hearings for five detainees charged in the 9/11 attacks will be held this week. Carol Rosenberg, reporter for the Miami Herald, will be covering the hearings at Gitmo and spoke with us about what we can expect from these latest hearings.
This week, we're going to be seeing for the first time a day-long closed hearing in the 9/11 case. No defendants, no media, and just the judge and the lawyers spending the day working on what we'll be allowed to see for the rest of the week. If you remember, the men accused in this case spent 3 and 4 years in CIA custody, and they're controlling the certain amount of information that's made public. And we're in the pretrial hearings. What they're doing is setting the conditions for an eventual trial. And that means you'll hear next to nothing about actually the September 11th attacks and a lot about what happened to them on their way to Guantanamo.
Part of the reason for that has to do with the fact that last time there was such a procedural mess associated with who could stop the proceedings, pull the ripcord, and prevent testimony from happening. And it seems like they're trying to get the ground rules set going in so that that doesn't happen this time.
In a sense, you know, there's a bit of kabuki theater going on here because the CIA has control over information regarding what happened to these men. And the attorneys, the defense attorneys, want it. They want it as a condition for going forward with trial, because while it may be inevitable that these guys will be convicted at this military tribunal of the September 11th attacks, the defense lawyers want to know what the CIA did to them on their way to Guantanamo, because they're trying to get the death penalty off the table. So these pretrial hearings are less about what happened on September 11th and more about how these men were treated during the 3 and 4 years when they didn't have lawyers, they weren't charged, they weren't on U.S. soil. And I'll give you an example. One of the motions that they're discussing in the closed session is how much we'll be able to hear about actually what the filmmakers of Zero Dark 30 learned from the CIA. Sounds a little bit weird, but the defense attorneys for one of the defendants says the CIA gave the makers of the movie more information about the dark sites than they've given to the defense lawyers. So they're going to go into this closed session. The defense lawyers are going to say, "Judge, we want to argue this motion in public." And the judge is going to have to figure out which part of a motion about the dark sites and a major motion picture can be discussed at a public hearing.
The theory, of course, that if they spoke with the movie people, how can this be classified and how can this be kept out of a court proceeding? It seems that the three sides here, or the three parties that you've mentioned anyway, have vastly different stakes. The defense attorneys, of course, want their clients to either get off or to get judged in light of all the evidence. The judge, I suspect, really wants this proceeding not to devolve into some sort of completely absurd circus. And I suspect the prosecution would just assume that we weren't doing this at all.
And the unseen stakeholder is the CIA, because they control so much of the information. And if the judge is as committed to transparency as he says, but bound by the rules of classification, he's walking this fine line in the closed session of figuring out what can be played out in public and what has to be done in what they call the 505s, the closed hearings, where, by the way, John, even the accused defendants whose lives are at stake can't attend because they don't have security clearances. Now, remember, the discussion is about what happened to them, and they know what happened to them, but they can't be at the discussions when they decide which part of what happened to them is classified.
Oh, that is remarkable. Any chance you will see Khalid Sheikh Mohammed or any of the defendants under any circumstances during this visit? And what about signs of the either eradication of Guantanamo Bay or the permanent infrastructure that's being built to make it a more or less permanent feature of U.S. national security?
We'll definitely see the accused. The judge has ordered them brought to court on Tuesday. They are ordered to court for at least one public session of every week-long hearing. We hear from them less and less because the judge has made it clear they will speak through their lawyers. In terms of the infrastructure, you know, they're at a bit of a standstill right now. They've got the war court. Southern Command, the U.S. military base in Miami, wants to build a lot more infrastructure. They want a new prison for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and his men. They say the other was maybe built on unstable land. But Congress, which wants to keep Guantanamo open, won't give them the money to build the new prison. So it's kind of a mix and match situation down there.
And as far as the hunger strike and the protests that were going on that were also a big story this year, any sense of that when you go down there?
Well, the hunger strike news is that the military has imposed a blackout and we no longer get daily updates on how many of the prisoners are hunger striking. If you remember, at the height, it was 106 prisoners. It had dropped to 11 a couple of weeks ago, and it had risen to 15 when they pulled the plug on transparency. Now we just don't know how many of the prisoners the military says meet their criteria for hunger striking and these nasogastric feedings that the prisoners say are forced feedings. They've just imposed this blackout, and we have very little visibility on it now.
Carol Rosenberg, reporter for the Miami Herald, headed to Guantanamo Bay for the latest on the Gitmo proceedings and the status of that national security operation. Carol, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Carol Rosenberg, reporter for the Miami Herald, will be covering the hearings at Gitmo and spoke with us about what we can expect from these latest proceedings. So echoes of the 9/11 attacks still playing out. You heard Glenn Greenwald earlier this hour. Do you believe we're safer today than we were before those attacks that caused so many changes in the U.S.?
This is Trish. I'm calling from Briarcliff Manor. And I think it's really hard to say if we are safer since 9/11. But what I do know, it's not because we take off our shoes at airports, and it's not because we get frisked going into every concert and sporting event.
Join the conversation at 8778-MY-TAKE or follow us on Twitter, at The Takeaway, all one word. At The Takeaway. Two longtime Hollywood voices silenced over the weekend. A loss that makes me feel sad and a bit old.
Oh, you're Beaky.
Well, that's what they used to call me at school. I happened to be driving by. I thought I'd just pop in for a cup of tea.
Well, I've heard so much about you, Mr. Thornton.
Johnny told me about you, too. I ran into him at Newbury Races last week.
The races?
Oh, put my foot in as usual, have I? I mean, didn't he tell you?
Johnny has a job. He couldn't have been at the races.
That's Joan Fontaine from the Hitchcock film Suspicion. Fontaine was a Hollywood legend, a mainstay, and a gifted actress who lived until the age of 96, who in the hereafter is possibly a little annoyed that she had to go at basically the same moment as this fellow.
The foot cannot be crossed.
I'll cross it if you will.
You? It takes more than a compass, Englishman. The foot is the worst place God created.
I can't answer for the place, only for myself.
Peter O'Toole in Lawrence of Arabia, a movie star and an actor who was in a category all by himself. The announcement that he had died at age 81 brought this from Irish President Michael Higgins. Ireland and the world has lost one of the giants of film and theater. O'Toole's acting career began on stage in England as a teenager. He was a TV pioneer and then got his big break in Lawrence of Arabia that instantly made him an international star. He once wrote of this experience. I woke up one morning to find I was famous. I bought a white Rolls Royce and drove down Sunset Boulevard wearing dark specs and a white suit, waving like the Queen Mum. Of O'Toole's legendary lust for life and embrace of stardom, there is only precision in the record. The biographical details of how this sprite of a genius came into this world, a little less precision.
The family version of my date and place of birth is June 1932 in Ireland. The same event is recorded as August of the same year at an accident hospital in England. My baptism was in November 1932, also in England. There are slight but charming variations of nomenclature on all three occasions.
That's Peter O'Toole reading from his memoir, Loitering with Intent, on the BBC. He was a classical actor in the mold of all the greats.
Oh, Thomas, I'm ashamed of this whole silly masquerade. All right. So I've come here to make my peace with their Saxon hero, because I need them now, those Saxon peasants of yours.
The 1964 Beckett with Richard Burton. And here with Katharine Hepburn in The Lion in Winter, it was as though two raging giants of the screen were summing up civilization itself.
None of you will get my kingdom, I leave you nothing, and I wish you plague, may all your children breach and die.
You go to Rome, we'll rise against you.
Who will?
Richard, Geoffrey, John, and Eleanor of Aquitaine.
The day those stout hearts band together is the day that pigs get weak.
There'll be pork in the treetops come morning.
O'Toole as an actor was also outrageous in his ability to make us believe, capable of stretching the limits of life and character. He played Jesus, or a loony heir to a fortune who believed himself to be Jesus. Miracle on 34th Street kind of meets One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Peter O'Toole in The Ruling Class.
I am the Lord Jesus, come again in my own body to heal the sick, the troubled, and the ignorant. I am he that liveth, and behold, I am alive for everyone. Is everybody happy? Now hear this. I come to proclaim the new dispensation. The gospel dispensation promised only salvation to the soul. The new dispensation gives it to the body as well.
O'Toole wrote this one time, I will not be a common man because it is my right to be an uncommon man. I will stir the smooth sands of monotony, he wrote, as a young man of his future, and he certainly made good on that promise. He said this one time about acting. The love of it is great, huge, and it will be with me forever. I blundered into it. I found I could do it well. It has raised me from nothing into something. Not a lot, but something. If you do something well and you enjoy it, what more can you bloody well ask? Peter O'Toole exits at age 81, as effortless and emotional a gesture as anything he ever did on stage.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Coming up a little later in the show, secret volcanoes underneath the earth. How does that make you feel? Does the beneath the earth mystery scare you more than what's happening on the surface? Well, we began this hour talking about the beneath-the-surface mysteries of how America conducts intelligence. We spoke with journalist Glenn Greenwald. He's a journalist. He's a commentator. He's also the person who facilitated Edward Snowden's leaks that transformed our understanding of how the U.S. collects intelligence. He said in our conversation earlier this hour that in the years since 9/11, America has become less safe than we had anticipated, given all of the changes that we made to be more vigilant about the war on terrorism. He actually said that it would have been better had we done nothing. Well, what do you think about all of that? Are we safer today than a decade ago? Do you care to comment on the notion of having had no response whatsoever to the attacks on September 11th, 2001? From Bluffton, South Carolina, one of you says, no, I don't believe we're more safe than a decade ago, but then I don't know what's really going on behind the scenes. Well, there you go. Lake Grove, Oregon, one of you says, the truth is, I'm not sure. I think we are safer from foreign threats now, but in the future, that's a different story. As for our domestic safety, I think we are very unsafe, due mainly to acts of unconstitutional powers, such as the Patriot Act and the National Security Agency, that have deteriorated the American civil rights. Lastly, our budget issues threaten our country the most. Coming up a little later this hour, possible threats to our economy from the debt in Puerto Rico. From Gonzales, Florida, one of you says, safer, yes, but at the expense of too many personal liberties. And we are heading into a very gray future with the NSA using artificial intelligence to track what we do and auto-decide what it may mean. The global state will get very interesting as other countries start using NSA-like technologies against their people and possibly us as well, but it's too late to go back now. Actually, Greenwald suggested that everyone using this technology, the proliferation of the NSA's capability, might actually be a constraint. It'll be a world of less privacy, but perhaps the U.S. won't be tempted to overreach. From Walnut Creek, California, one of you said, a lot of the things enacted are more intrusive than they need to be, but I feel just as safe as I did before the attacks.
My name is Christine, and I'm calling from Queens. And I do believe that we're definitely safer. There are more precautions being taken, and our government is helping us to become more aware of terrorism and terroristic acts around the world. I certainly am more vigilant. I do believe in that motto, if you see something, say something.
If you see something, say something. People in New York, of course, are very familiar with that slogan, and people around the country as well. Vigilance is different from safety. We may be more vigilant, and we may feel less safe. The question is, how do we evaluate the reality of the situation? Some views from three of you now.
Robert Morgan from Carrollton, Texas. I do believe we're safer than we've been before, but not in proportion to the number of new policies enacted since 9/11.
Hi, this is Mickey Curry from Massapequa Park. No, I don't really feel any safer. These days, I tend to be more concerned about the government.
I'm Donna Norman. Yes, I do feel much safer. Now, if we can just get some movement toward gun control, I will feel even more safe.
If you go back to the Federalist Papers and think about what the framers of the Constitution talked about when they talked about safety from who and whom, it was safety and protection from the government that concerned them most. The notion of terrorism, of course, wasn't around. Are we safe from the government? Are we safe from threats outside the United States? Join the conversation. You know how to get in touch with us. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Post a comment at thetakeaway.org. React to what Glenn Greenwald told us earlier this hour or anything else on the program. And now we've seen this pattern before. The apparent security of government, particularly the U.S. government, attracts investors willing to lend at favorable interest rates. Government entities tempted by the easy money use it to finance public works projects, essentially using borrowed funds to eventually drive the operating budget of the entire government entity. This has happened in American cities, in publicly backed utilities. In many ways, the real estate bubble that exploded in 2008 and practically brought down the entire global financial system stemmed from mortgage-backed securities guaranteed by the federal Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, able to be rated as though they were as reliable as treasury bills themselves. But when it all unraveled, well, we know the result. Detroit's current bankruptcy troubles are the result of easy money and a declining tax base for a city in industrial decline. We take up now the curious case of Puerto Rico. It's something of a hybrid, currently experiencing the same economic decline of a Detroit, but it also benefits from the economic crutch of being a federally supported U.S. territory. So when Puerto Rico borrows, it looks as though its debt may be backed by the U.S. Treasury. $70 billion in debt right now, an economy mired in recession, and a population seemingly making a quick exit. 1.5% of the population departed for the United States between 2010 and 2012. What's going on? Ingrid Vila is chief of staff to Puerto Rico's governor, Alejandro García Padilla. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
So I imagine this looks a bit like an emergency from where you sit in Puerto Rico, even though Americans, generally speaking, don't know a lot about it.
Well, what we're facing in Puerto Rico right now, and we have to put in context, this is an administration that started January 2013. At the point where we inherited a debt in our budget of almost $2,200 million, and we had a problem, obviously, in terms of our economic growth. We have we had also an issue with our central pension system and fiscal situations that had not been addressed in the past. What we have done in the 11 months that we have been in office, we have handled this head on, addressing the most ambitious reform in a pension system that I think has been executed in the past years and probably historically, even taking into consideration states of the United States. And we have reduced our debt burden in our current fiscal year from the $2,200 million, which I mentioned, to $800 million. And we have a fiscal plan that is heading to resolve that fiscal debt in the next 2 years. So comparisons to other cities, to other states, to other situations should not be made in this case for several reasons. First of all, Puerto Rico is quite different, like you mentioned. It's a fiscally autonomous commonwealth, and that enables us, obviously, much more flexibility. We don't pay federal income tax on source income. And we have, like I mentioned, flexibility to impose higher taxes vis-a-vis other state counterparts. We are addressing the issues that we are facing. And like we have said in many instances, both locally and in U.S. media, we will solve this situation and Puerto Rico will not be facing any of the issues that you have seen perhaps other cities in the
right.
United States.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of those tax advantages that attracted businesses for a while, not so much lately. And I'm wondering if, and given the fact that 4 out of 5 or an overwhelming majority of mutual funds hold Puerto Rican debt, do you think Puerto Rican debt issues were at one time rated as though they were going to be bailed out by the federal government? They're certainly not rated that way now.
Well, Puerto Rican, we have to correct that, I think, that premise. And it's not, there's no bailing out from the U.S. Treasury. Our debt, the debt that we issue, is backed up by our local Commonwealth resources. And it has been rated that way. All evaluations and all information that has been put forth in terms of the Commonwealth has always been stated that way. So I think that could be a misconception that it has perhaps come out in the media, but it's not a correct statement.
And do you think that the popularity of Puerto Rican debt has fueled a sense of easy money and a temptation to use borrowed money to fund operations in Puerto Rico?
Well, like I mentioned, in the past 10 to 15 years, Puerto Rico obviously issued a considerable amount of debt. to finance public investment in the majority of occasions. The situation we have right now is that obviously Puerto Rico entered into a recession starting in 2006 and has been in that recession in the past 7 years. That obviously has created an issue in terms of generating income in the Commonwealth. That's why since day one we have been promoting and putting forth an economic development plan, which we have been quite successful in the past 11 months, precisely to jumpstart our economy again. As you probably know, there was a Section 936, which allowed U.S. Companies to establish themselves here and have certain incentives for that establishment. That structure basically expired or was eliminated in the late 90s, and that obviously caused an exit of a considerable amount of jobs in Puerto Rico. We're in the process of reestablishing our industrial base, reinjecting investment in Puerto Rico to jumpstart our economy again, and that will definitely get us into the next phase of the Puerto Rican economy.
There are financial observers who liken Puerto Rico to a sort of a Greece in terms of its relationship with the United States. There's a dependence there. You can't declare bankruptcy because you're a territory in the way that Detroit can. What do you think the solution is here? Some sort of austerity program which brought people into the streets in Greece? Or is it some sort of aid program, some kind of federal assistance program that's going to ease your way out of this?
No, I think neither. Obviously, we have a very good relationship with the current Obama administration and with the federal government. And we have established working groups to maximize the utilization of federal funding and federal funding that is available for Puerto Rico, make sure that we're getting all those federal funds, obviously, to promote economic development, like I mentioned. Puerto Rico is, like I mentioned, and you know, a commonwealth. And our debt, obviously, Puerto Rico has in its constitution, it establishes that public debt is constitutionally protected and is the first claim on Commonwealth resources. So the situation in Puerto Rico is quite different. That's why I think comparisons should not be made even with other countries or states or cities.
All right. Ingrid Vila is the chief of staff to Puerto Rico's Governor Alejandro Garcia Padilla, talking about the debt crisis in Puerto Rico. Ingrid Vila, thanks so much.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
We began this hour talking about things out of sight in the U.S. government's conduct of intelligence. Now a look at some phenomena between our planet's surface that have, at one time, and could, again, radically change things for us surface dwellers.
Giant ash cloud created by this super volcano!
That guy's crazy, right, Daddy?
I don't think so.
It's gonna
popping off all over the city.
The west side is a million people.
There are going to be a million dead people if we don't evacuate.
When Mount St. Helens blew, the force was greater than the Hiroshima bomb.
I don't know where I'm going to go when the volcano blows.
Take Yellowstone National Park, for instance. Good place to wait out the volcano, right? It's known for the geothermally driven geyser Old Faithful that boils over on schedule, heated from volcanic processes below the surface of an active seismic zone. But that little bit of moisture, it turns out, is just a tiny down payment on the possibility of a huge volcanic eruption beneath Yellowstone. A volcano without a picturesque mountain cone. No, no, no. Just the ability to pack a planet-shaking and possibly continent-splitting punch, according to some scientific revelations presented this month to the American Geophysical Union. David Ferguson is with us now, postdoctoral research scientist at Columbia University's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory. David, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
So Yellowstone, scary place, because underneath it is a gigantic volcano, super volcano. I guess you guys don't like to say super anything, right?
So the term super volcano is an informal term, but it's becoming more common in scientific discussion. And it really just refers to a type of volcanic system that is capable in, on some occasions, of producing eruptions that are really at the top end of the size of eruptions that have happened throughout Earth history. Really, you know, staggeringly large events, but also very rare events.
And let's just talk a little bit, because if you look at the geology of the United States, there's a giant sort of lake of lava that pretty much forms the Pacific Northwest from an eruption that took place, I don't know, a long, long time ago. I was in Africa recently, and there's all this evidence in Southwest Africa of underground eruptions that are just eroding away. So you have these mountains that actually were part of eruptions that took place hundreds of millions of years ago under the ground.
Sure. So when a volcano erupts, what we see coming out at the surface is actually typically a small percentage of the magma that is feeding the eruption. And so a lot of that magma never makes it to the surface. It cools down, it crystallizes underground, forming igneous rocks. And then if over time the ground surface is eroded away, we see the roots of those volcanoes exposed at the surface. So in Africa, for example, there is the root of a very large old volcanic system that is now exposed at the surface.
So what is the chance that the continent of North America could be remade by the forces beneath Yellowstone if this blows? And do you have the capability of even monitoring it? I covered the Mount St. Helens eruption, which was something that happened pretty much above the surface for the entire time and was pretty easy to monitor compared with some of the stuff you're talking about.
So, well, an eruption at Yellowstone is a very well-monitored place, and it's incredibly unlikely that anything would happen without quite a long period of increasing activity. So I think we would certainly know about it. And it's important to say, I think, that although we know that Yellowstone has produced very large eruptions, eruptions of the size that would certainly affect the continental U.S., these are far rarer than its typical activity. And for every one of these eruptions, there are tens to hundreds of much smaller eruptions that happen more frequently.
So when you guys at the observatory there, Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory, think about where on the planet forces of the scale of what have been seen to form the continents are likely to occur, is there a map where you go, well, sure, I'm going to be over here? You know, things – we're not talking about pop-offs. We're talking about lakes of lava, right?
Yeah. So it's – for Yellowstone, it's not quite a lake of lava. It's more it's a region under the park that contains a certain percentage of molten rock. In the case of this new study, they model that as about 10%. And that would be the magma that would feed a future eruption. In terms of where we might find these volcanic systems on the Earth, there are really three places. At the boundaries between tectonic plates, either where these plates are being pulled apart, such as in the middle of the oceans, where these plates come together, such as the west coast of America, or in the case of Yellowstone, regions where we believe hot material from deeper in the Earth, a region called the mantle, is being pulsed upwards in a plume or like a jet. And when that impinges on the Earth's crust, it's hot enough to generate quite a lot of magma. And we believe that Yellowstone is the surface manifestation of a very hot region within the Earth.
All right, let me try to decode that a little bit. You've got in the West plates coming together.
Yes.
And this would be a typical zone of serious seismic activity. But Yellowstone stands out because in the midst of these plates coming together, there's like a pressure hole in the mantle.
Sure.
That's creating this
yeah,
bubble.
Yeah, there's a region of anomalously hot material beneath Yellowstone. And we know that that's been active for in fact, tens of millions of years. The Yellowstone volcano is the latest surface expression of that. And that's providing a very steady supply of magma that makes its way up into the crust, that ponds beneath Yellowstone, and every so often will reach sufficient pressure to burst out and cause an eruption.
Have you seen a volcano?
Been lucky enough. Yeah. Being a volcanologist, I'm lucky enough to travel to many volcanoes,
right,
in Africa, Hawaii, Chile, Iceland.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, lucky.
They're spectacular and amazing phenomena.
Yeah, so deep down in your heart, you want to be able to see one of these things, right? You want, come on. You want one of these continental blow things.
It would be fascinating scientifically.
Yeah.
It would present, I think, a major challenge to civilization.
Yeah, to civilization.
But yeah, it would be
a fascinating
event. I think since I currently live in the continental U.S., I would probably hope hope against Yellowstone Eruption.
You're a stakeholder. Kind of a competing stakeholder.
Yes.
Part of your stake is living in North America. The other part is being a seismologist.
Yes. And of course, an eruption the size of Yellowstone, there would be no way to really witness it and survive within 100 or several hundred kilometers of the volcano.
Oh, well, that's unfortunate.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess you'd have to stay in the observatory up
there
in Columbia.
Sure, or if you had a satellite or something.
they have these.
They do have these. That would be the best way to monitor an eruption of that scale.
Trying as hard as he can not to cackle over the possibility of a continent-ending eruption, David Ferguson, postdoctoral research scientist at Columbia University's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Secrets deep below the ground and secrets being kept by our government in its conduct of intelligence. Earlier on the program, we spoke with journalist Glenn Greenwald, who says that in the years since September 11th, 2001, America has become less safe. His response, do nothing at all, based on what he says the consequences were of what we actually ended up doing. What do you think? Are we safer today than a decade ago? Here's Emily in Charleston, South Carolina.
I absolutely do not think we are a safer country. I think it was an unfortunate opportunity for our government to change the very principles that we were founded on.
One of you in Augusta, Georgia says we're much less safe. Not only are we in more jeopardy because our government has exacerbated anti-American sentiment abroad, as well as putting innocent Americans at incredible risk from the very people and institutions that claim to be protecting them. And one of you in Anoka, Minnesota, yes, we are safer from existing threats, but new threats are arising at a very rapid pace. Tell us your story. Weigh in on this conversation at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can send a tweet at The Takeaway. Catch up on that or listen back to anything on the program at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.